Now both recorders are on, and I might just start by saying this is Raymond C. Ferguson, and I'm interviewing J. Burton Nichols at his home in Bellevue Manor, north of Wilmington. Today is January 14th, 1986, in the early afternoon. Your wife calls you Burton. Do you prefer Burton or Bert?
Bert.
Bert. I thought that's what you were known as at work.
I started out as Nick in Wisconsin.
Is that right?
So Bert is the preferred one.
I know you were born in 1902, but we don't have a record of where.
In Denver, Connecticut.
Okay. And can you tell us something about your parents?
Well, my father, who was a farmer, died when I was 4 months old, leaving my mother with a small daughter and me, and my grandmother to take care of. And so she supported us. I went through high school and was able to get a tuition scholarship from Cornell. At the time, this was a beneficent cost of $100 a term.
This was the scholarship or the tuition?
The tuition. Well, tuition and the scholarship. The scholarship covered the tuition.
I see. What about your living expenses and so on?
Oh, they might have run $600 or so. I don't remember now.
Did you work or?
Oh yes.
Do something to make
your
expenses?
I did some dishwashing. I worked at a soda fountain from say 10 to 12 at night, and to about 1 on Saturday nights.
This was at Ithaca?
Yes.
Could I back up first about your mother? What was her education and her background?
Well, I think just a housewife, except that to support us, she worked with the, well, a couple things. One was in the hatting industry. I think she was trimming hats, that being the main industry in Danbury at that time. And then she worked with a, I think it was a Rogers silver plating company, who had a shop or a plant just a few doors from us. So it was very convenient. So that on one time when I was quite young, let's say 5, I got my head stuck in the exit of the chicken coop. We were allowed chickens in the city at that time. So she came home and got someone to free me, since she was so close to me.
What was your father's name?
James Henry.
Mm-hmm. And your mother's?
Martha B. Martha Barnum.
That was her family name, Barnum?
No, Wildman.
Wildman. I think in an earlier draft of your biography, you said they were English and Welsh descent.
Yes,
or something.
She was on the Welsh side, and my grandmother was on the English side. Well, father and grandmother.
Did she have something like a high school education, or that much?
Oh, yes, I think she had that much. I just don't know.
I was curious as to whether it was family influence or principally the school influence that got you interested in science.
No. I really was heading toward a career in civil engineering, since that was the popular thing for the boys in those days. They were building bridges and all sorts of things. I'm sure glad that I didn't go into that field when the Depression came along.
Could we stop a minute and just check and see how our tapes are doing?
Sure. Stand up.
Yeah. That,
So, I'm about to say how I got into science, wasn't I?
Yes, one thing I was going to ask a little bit more. You've already alluded to what Danbury, Connecticut was like in those days. It was an industrial town, wasn't it?
And it was one of the first stopping places for the immigration people. The Irish came over, of course, and later the Italians and
Polish?
Polish. To some extent, but
my wife's family was Polish.
Lisbon. What's the country?
Portugal.
The Portuguese came too.
Mm-hmm.
But the Irish were really the really hard workers. They dug the ditches and they did all sorts of things, but they made their way.
I assume you went to public schools then, from kindergarten through high school.
Yes.
And how large was your high school?
We had a graduating class of 100.
Uh-huh.
So it was the general order of 400, I suppose, 400 to 500.
Now, in your interview with John Smith, you said that your school superintendent, Borsch, wished you to go to Cornell instead of Yale.
Yes.
And you had already gotten an interest in chemistry from
your
high school.
Yes, because I took that in my senior year.
Was there, what was taught in high school chemistry in those days?
I suppose a little bit of analytical, probably made a few compounds.
Do you remember a laboratory? Did you have your own lab?
We had a laboratory, so we could make titrations. I remember that much.
Mm-hmm.
But not too much more that I remember at the moment.
A little bit of work on combustion or Priestley theory or gas laws?
The atom was indivisible, a hard ball. In those
Is that right?
Uh-huh. This was... I was in high school 15 to 19.
Right.
And the recent work hadn't crept into the textbooks by that time. So the atom was still indivisible.
Now, I think when I was in high school in the 30s, I finally heard about the electron. I think that was Anderson's work. Was publicized and probably in popular press in the mid-30s.
Anderson or Chadwick or somebody.
Somebody. I remember the name Anderson. May not be right. So what effect did World War I have on you and your family? Any particular?
No particular effect. I was in high school during that, and we all had war gardens, so war bonds, and otherwise there wasn't any particular effect. Well, we had the shortages, of course, and the winter when there was no coal to speak of, so we high school kids went out and chopped wood. I had a 3-acre woodlot from my father's family, so we would chop dead chestnut trees, which were still there, and oak and so forth. And so we had wood for ourselves, and we had probably wood to sell.
Now, turning to your time at Cornell again, I think in your other interviews you said there were about 40 people with you in the chemistry program.
Yes, that was our class.
In one class.
Yes.
How many were women?
Oh, it most, I would say, half a dozen. I remember one, Hildegard Pear. That was her name, Hildegard Pear. She was from Tupper Lake up in the Adirondacks. She was French-Canadian.
You remember how that was spelled?
I think Pear was P-A-Y-E-R, and I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But Hildegard would be a German extract.
Sounds like it. Yeah. How many were on the faculty, in the chemistry faculty?
Possibly 20. That's mm-hmm. only a guess. Dennis was still the king. He was called the king. He was chairman of the department.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked under Bancroft.
Now, what was your goal and expectation from the Bachelor of Chemistry degree?
Oh, I hadn't got very far in expectations. Oh, but it was with Bancroft that I had my first introduction to a high polymer. I didn't know it was that when I worked on the molecular weight of nitrocellulose.
Yeah, I noted that you were... in fact, you wrote a paper under your own name
yes.
on that work. Was this senior research a requirement
yeah.
or something you undertook for special credit?
No, that was senior research.
I see.
The seniors were either allowed or supposed to have a small project at that time.
What was the motivation behind studying nitrocellulose?
Just looked like something that I could do, I guess.
Clearly was an exposure to high polymer, but you weren't thinking that the term wasn't used in those days,
no.
I gather.
All I could determine was that if it had a molecular weight, it was quite high.
What subjects were required in the undergraduate chemistry degree there?
Well, this was essentially, it was a BChem degree, and at that time it was essentially a chem engineering degree.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give any degree as such. That was before the day of Rhodes. In fact, he came about halfway through my course and brought a breath of fresh air in, because he came in directly from the Bayer Company, where he was chief chemist. So he introduced problem courses. He would tell about how they worked out solutions to problems in the plant, like tracing the inventory of materials as they went through and catching a place where the leak was, and all sorts of practical things.
Were the other faculty strictly academic types?
Yes.
With more classical traditions?
Yes. It hadn't got to the stage where everybody was consulting with some chemical concern or otherwise.
That didn't come along until quite a bit later, did it? Or
yes, it must have been, well, probably in the 30s.
I'm jumping ahead, of course, when I looked at the first DuPont organization charts, the chemical department charts. There were four consultants in 1925. And one was Reed, I guess.
Yes, yes, he was Perrine.
And right offhand, I've got them somewhere, but I can't remember who the others were.
Adams could have been one.
Adams, I think, hadn't come on board yet in 25. That was
Marvel had not come on
board. No, right. We could look that up and come back to it. But
sure.
You have the breakdown of subjects like inorganic, organic, analytical?
Oh, yes, we had
your
courses
curriculum.
in organic chemistry and if you weren't good enough to exempt the final, you were in trouble, because Uncle Billy Orndorff gave pretty stiff finals.
This was in inorganic? Or
no, organic.
Organic.
Yes.
Oh.
You made preparations and such things.
There was a physical chemistry
yes.
course. Do you remember who taught that?
Inorganic was Professor Brown, Arthur Brown. He gave the introductory freshman chemistry course, too. Mm-hmm. I just can't think who the physical chemist was.
I don't blame you. I can't remember.
I took microscopy, and Chameau was still active at that point.
Oh, Chameau was there?
Yes, he was really the one that introduced the subject to the country.
He was analytical chemist? What did he classify himself?
I don't know. And his prize student was Clyde Mason, who actually, after I got through and was going to Wisconsin, suggested that I start a course out there, which I was flattered, but I didn't want to get tied up that way.
I mean, he was asking you to teach a course in microscopy?
Yeah, to organize one out there.
So Mason was, was he at that time a professor, or he was
an
instructor?
He was assistant professor, I think, at that point.
That's interesting. I'd like to come back to, I had some questions about microscopy, but
we had an elementary spectroscopy course, and that was Papish. Using the flame for the elements.
So this was atomic spectroscopy?
Yeah. Not infrared.
Optical, or just visual observation?
Yes.
Or did you use some sort of dispersive element to get a spectrum?
We must have had a prism.
Yes. Oh, very interesting. Going back to your work on nitrocellulose with Bancroft, you aware, or was anybody at that time of Staudinger's interest and ideas about polymers, or was that,
that was too
not
early
in the literature yet?
See, that was in 1922, let's say.
So
Staudinger may have been just starting that line of work.
But there wasn't, as far as you know, there wasn't anything in the literature.
At least it didn't percolate down to
yeah,
the
right.
undergraduate.
Did you have a lot of journals to read, a lot of reading to do as an undergraduate?
I don't recall. We didn't have too many journals in those days.
I guess not. At Cornell, it was probably the same.
Because the American Chemical series had not separated too many yet. We had the Journal of Physical Chemistry, which Bancroft ran, and the Journal of American Chemical Society. But I can't recall whether even the Journal of Industrial Engineering Chemistry had started at that time.
May have been too early, I don't know. Did you, going on to Cornell, or as a graduate student, you'd more likely have had
yes.
exposure to the foreign journals, I suppose, as
yeah.
well as the U.S. journals.
Yeah, we had a fair library there. We had all of our time in the remains of a burned-out chemistry building, which had burned, I guess, 2 or 3 years before I got there.
This was at
Cornell.
Cornell.
Yes. So it was a one-story just the lower story was there with a roof over it. And we took our qualitative chemistry in the, up in the attic of Rockefeller Hall, which was the physics building. And when this large group of students, that is, there were a number of arts students taking it too, just as an introductory course. When they all got working with hydrogen sulfide, the air just got so that you couldn't see across the lawn. And I don't think that anybody ever got too much. Well, there were one or two cases where somebody got too much hydrogen sulfide and dropped. But no vitality.
There was, I think even when I was in school in the 40s, the attitude toward safety at colleges and universities was pretty cavalier.
I don't think they knew the word. I'm not sure.
Sort of a sort of macho.
Yeah.
Chemist didn't.
But I remember one occasion in the organic lab. I was making ether and distilling it, and with a Bunsen burner underneath. And for some reason, I decided I'd better shut off that burner, take it away, and this balloon flask cracked almost immediately. So I didn't actually get a fire.
Oh, you were in the working in a closed still though. I mean, you weren't getting ether vapors out in
the room. No, but the main vessel cracked
and
let it out. So I'd have had a pretty bad fire.
Yes, you would have. You remarked that Bancroft was a real character. What was his field?
It was colloid chemistry.
Colloid chemistry. What did you mean by his personally an unusual person or what?
Yes, it's a little hard to say. Let's say he didn't think in straight lines. I judge that he was probably more like an English chemist. Well, I think he was English, actually. So it had a broader education than most professors at the time. Or in chemistry, at least. So that tinged his writings. He always had something interesting in his Journal of Physical Chemistry that made good reading rather than just scientific knowledge.
Were there anybody else that you can think of at Cornell that particularly influenced your future career?
Possibly the professor that I had for calculus. He was I forget his name even by now, but he somehow instilled in me a way of mathematical thinking, which, however, did not go as far as I would like. I didn't get any farther than differential equations, and that was it. That I went on and took a couple of math courses at Wisconsin. But the head of the engineering department at that time, I can't think of his name, I can get it for you, gave a course in, I think it was industrial organization, which was very interesting. He was a good lecturer. I think I have his book here, actually.
Yeah, well, we might, we can always pick up on things like that later when you go to edit the transcript if you want to make additions. Well, I'd like to move on to Svedberg, since this really interests us. And I noted that in one of his patents with you, he lists himself as Theodore Svedberg.
He was born Theodore, but he adopted Tay very early in life.
I'd often wondered whether he did this because of the English meaning of the.
I don't think so.
I and other people have... when we saw that, you know, set him aside as the one and only.
I never asked him point blank.
Well, doubt it. How did you come to meet him?
I was just coming to that. I finished in 3.5 years at Cornell because it turned out I had 3 years of French and 3 years of German in high school. And they gave me credit for my German. So I came with some credits already, and I took fairly heavy schedules. So at the beginning of my senior year, I found out I had only enough work to do to finish in mid-year. And so Bancroft told me in December, I think it was, that this young Swedish professor was coming over to spend a spring term at Wisconsin, and was stopping at Rochester to give a lecture at Eastman Kodak. He said, you better go up and see him. Maybe you will want to go out there for a while. And so I did in early in January, sometime in January, and very much impressed, because I expected to see one of these sort of staid, whiskered European professors, fairly plump, but here was this very slender, boyish, enthusiastic person, looked like a very good man to work for or with. He was about 38 or so at that time.
I think he would have been 39 year at that year, and he would have been 38 or 39, and he would have been professor of physical chemistry at Uppsala for about 10 or 11 years at that time.
Already, yes. He was one of the youngest professors at the time he became a professor.
But he had already an established reputation and some distinction, didn't he? I was wondering why he happened to come to Wisconsin.
Because Professor Matthews, the head of the department, had the idea that he would like to establish a colloid chemistry course at Wisconsin, and even an institute for colloid chemistry. And so he was the one that asked him to come and teach in the spring and summer, in lectures and laboratory work. So there was a group of, I don't know, 12-15 that came for the spring term and took the various projects that most of what he had to offer. Some of them brought a project with them that they wanted to work on, such as Dick Bradfield, who was a well-known soil chemist at that time at Rollo, Missouri, I think it was. He later went to Cornell and became very well-known. In fact, there is now a building named, a soils building named for him.
So were these 12 or 15 people that came with Svedberg mostly already established, or were they graduate
students? Well, some of them were just fresh out of graduate school. Al Stamm, for example, came from Caltech, and I think he had just graduated. whether he had it, he may have had his PhD at that time, I'm not sure. But he then later went on to the Forest Products Laboratory at Madison and became one of the foremost wood chemists on structure of wood. I don't think he went into the chemical aspect so much, but he did a lot of work on wood. And then after he retired from Forest Products, he went down to Raleigh and became a professor there until just recently.
This is Raleigh, Missouri, at the University of Missouri? Or
no, this is Raleigh.
North Carolina. Raleigh, North Carolina, okay.
He died just this last year, so in fact, most of my friends that I knew at that time have died.
In their biography that Tiselius and Clayson wrote on Svedberg that appeared in the Reviews of Physical Chemistry, they stated that Svedberg's invitation to Madison came at a very opportune time and was really a turning point in his career, because did you sense that, or did he feel that way?
I think so, because the enthusiasm he showed was really something.
I gathered from what they said that the research funding and the conditions in Sweden for research immediately after World War I were pretty bad.
It was discouraging. It was pretty insular, that each professor sort of made do with what he could.
Well, then you enrolled immediately as a graduate student there at Wisconsin, is that right?
Yes, I made my decision immediately sometime in the last, I don't remember just when my first contact was, but it probably was around the middle of January. And so then by the 9th of February I was out there, and I had selected my problem.
Had you considered graduate school elsewhere?
No, I hadn't really. I had had some talks with Eastman Kodak that I might go there. In fact, when I went up to meet Svedberg, I made a couple of contacts. But he was the deciding factor for me to go on to graduate. Of course, the salaries were very high in those days. B-Chem, undergraduate degree, got $125 a month. And that was stable for several years, these prices, these salaries. And PhD got $200.
And these would be salaries at Kodak, industrial salaries.
Yeah, and the same thing, roughly, at DuPont.
Right. How about financial support at Wisconsin? Was this provided?
Let me go back. After my first year, that'd be 1920, I applied for they called it a bursary, Knickerbocker bursary. It was set up by some man in New York. And so I was successful in getting that, and it amounted to about $900 a year. So I was able to, I don't think I had to go through those stages of working late at night behind the soda fountain. I could make my way. And I had joined the Alpha Chi Sigma fraternity by that time also.
And is that a social fraternity or
no, that's a chemical.
Chemical.
Mm-hmm. So that my expenses were not very high, because that was a sort of a cooperative house.
And you there was also an Alpha Chi Sigma at Wisconsin.
Yes, so I went immediately there, and so I was right in the middle of things.
Did this Knickerbocker bursary continue at when you went to Wisconsin?
I see it was for my completion of the 4 years, and they allowed me to take the final term portion along with me to Wisconsin, so that really tided me over. And by that time I was a lab assistant, and I was getting, I think, $50 a month, which kept me going.
Good. Now, you already said, well, it was obvious to me that you had, as soon as you got there, you must have gotten to work on your optical centrifuge, because
yes,
you had a paper with Svedberg published in December of 23.
Yes.
You started out immediately.
Yeah.
Did you also have coursework going on at the same time?
Oh, yes. Yes, the regular graduate schedule. There were some good men there at Wisconsin at that time. Professor Leonard, Sam Leonard's father, was a professor of analytical chemistry. I'm not sure. Could have been energetic, but anyway, he had done a lot of work with some of the elements. And he was a graduate of European University, so he was quite a proud man. Sam got some of his bearing from him.
Can you think of some others offhand?
Professor Daniels had come just about a year or so before I got there. So I was associated with him. We took the first course in chemical thermodynamics, the book by, I've forgotten, I have it here, Lewis and Randall.
Right.
Which was the first work on thermodynamics that was understandable by an ordinary person. And it was full of problems. So we worked from the manuscript. Daniels was reviewing it, and so we had the benefit before it was even published. Well, that really opened our eyes to what a good foundation of thermodynamics would have in the study of reactions. There were others.
Let's see, Wisconsin later had some outstanding analytical chemists. That may have been after your time.
Yes, that was well after. Willard was one.
Willard.
But that was long after. And there were others.
Who was the organic man there?
That was Homer Adkins. He was a good man. And all of our Wisconsin people that came to Pont had taken their organic with him, the same as those that came from Illinois took it from either Roger Adams or
Marble. Right. How did you and Svedberg work together on this optical centrifuge?
He let me pretty much developed my ideas, which were pretty poor, as you might expect with a young graduate student without any particular background. My mechanical background was not very good. I'd had a number of courses in engineering in connection with my courses at Cornell, so they say that I didn't get into too many troubles. But if he had worked on it himself, it would have probably been a much more polished sort of thing.
Was he an accomplished machinist, or
he knew pretty much what he wanted.
Mm-hmm. You started with a Dunmore high-speed motor.
Dumore.
Well, this was a electric.
This was a high-speed grinding motor. It had an extension shaft, and carried usually a small grinding wheel. So, for that purpose, it would go up to 20,000. Then I put this heavy head on there, and I never got more than about 2,000.
This was a shaft vertically mounted, driving some sort of something like a cream separator concept, or was it a standard centrifuge design?
The Dumore motor alone you could hold in your hand and get around to the various surfaces. This was mounted in a heavy block.
Uh-huh.
And I actually put sandbags around the outside because I was expecting higher speeds.
And this was a direct electric drive.
Yeah.
Is that right? And then you cut slots through the...
We had this brass cylinder. And slots for direct light, and also you could look at angles to get the scattered light for colloidal material.
And I gather you did some pigments.
Yes, one of the people that came when Svedberg was there was a Henrietta Liebe, L-I-E-B-E, from one of the pigments companies. Acme, I guess it was. Probably no longer in existence. And so she brought a series of samples, representative samples from various manufacturers. She wanted to run a comparison, so I ran those for her.
And what was her background? Was she a...
I think she was a PhD.
PhD, with that name, sounded like she might have been German.
Could well be.
Was she from German university, or
I don't know. But anyway, this was a good choice in a sense, because since they were relatively coarse, I had to use a high viscosity medium. I dispersed them in glycerin, 95% glycerin, so that the convection was not as bad as it would have been in an aqueous suspension. But there are a lot of things wrong with the first design, which showed up and enabled Svedberg to design on his way over by ship back to Sweden what he thought would be a workable centrifuge.
Now, at that time, for particle size determination, you had optical microscopy?
Yeah, and
this was
electron microscopy.
Was there electron microscopy?
Yes. So many nights I spent up until 12 or 1 o'clock counting fields of gold, colloidal gold particles. And I found that
you
I
did that work at Wisconsin
yes.
as well?
Yeah. I found I could get about the same result with my eyes open and or closed, because the essential thing was to make a dilution down to a point where you could count at a glance no more than five, because they were streaming by, or slowly streaming by, depending on the stillness of the atmosphere, so you can just...
And this is in the, the microscope?
Yeah, and it had a metronome, so you'd count, say, each second or something like that.
And this was the in the microscopy, or the...
This was the ultramicroscope, yes.
And what would particle size range are we talking about? 300 micrometers?
No, they'd be down somewhere in the range 20 to 50, probably.
That's small.
The so-called Faraday saw, which would just give a blur in the ultramicroscope, would be down close to 3. But of course, with that heavy dense, they are easy to centrifuge. When the first working ultra centrifuge was developed in Sweden, because the man that was associated with Swedberg had done a number of years work on gold souls and such for his doctorate.
So you had your gold soul samples were things you made, or
was
it?
Yes, because they have a pretty short life, really. They start to grow or flock.
Right. Well, let's see. I think we need to push on. Although I'd be happy that we can stop anytime you want to take a break or pause. So, what did Swedberg require of you then? Just the work on the centrifuge, or did you have other things to do for him?
When I was in Sweden?
When you were at, let's talk about Wisconsin first.
I was his lecture assistant, so I had things to prepare during the summer of the session.
He lectured on colloids, colloid chemistry?
And he had a number of demonstrations, and one was the preparation of colloidal metals by an arc or spark.
Let's see, I think that one is run off. Let's see what this one is. This one has a beeper, I think. But I guess we might as well pause here while I change the tapes and we get started on the other side.